This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
All right, my guest today is the owner of Cerro Gordo, an original Boomtown silver mine established in 1865. He currently lives on a mountain above Death Valley with no running water, seven cats, six goats, and at least one ghost. Brent Underwood, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So tell me a little bit about Cerro Gordo. What is Cerro Gordo and how did you come to be the owner and come to be living there?
Yeah, I ask myself that a lot, but Cerro Gordo is a mining town from the 1800s. And I think just to set the scene a little bit for everybody, it's located about 3 hours northeast of Los Angeles. It's about 3 hours west of Las Vegas. And we're up in the mountains. Sometimes I think people think ghost towns, they think desert, and we are in the desert, but we're in the high desert. So I'm sitting at about 8,500 feet in elevation right now. And out my front window, I can see Mount Whitney and the Sierra Nevada. So I see all these snow-capped peaks. And if I turn around the other way and I look out my back window, I see Death Valley National Park. And so we're kind of on a crest. It's a really interesting high-low contrast up here. But the town was established in 1865. And primarily they were mining galena, which is a silver and lead ore. And so the town started about 1865. It became a boom town within, I'd say, 5 or 6 years. It was the place to be kind of in California if you're a miner. You know, this was just after the gold rush. The miners were looking for different things to do. It sprung up to be about, at its peak, 4,000 residents, probably in the 1880s. There was 4,000 people living here, which is crazy to think about because at that point in time, the closest port city to get all the supplies for Cerro Gordo was Los Angeles, which is where you are right now. And at that point in time, this town probably had about 4,000 residents and Los Angeles only had about 6,500 residents. So they're almost like equal trading partners, more so than like one little mining town and one, you know, major metropolis like it is now. And so they mined silver here to about the 1890s. They lost the vein and then everybody kind of packed it up and left. And then in 1910, a guy named L.D. Gordon came along, and L.D. built the house that I'm actually sitting in right now, and he discovered zinc. So when everybody was paying attention to the silver and lead, nobody was paying attention to the zinc. And so starting around 1910, he mined zinc into the 1940s. And so for a mine, the active life here was 1865 to 1940, which is a really long life for a mine. You know, usually they thought these camps would last 5 or 6 years and then kind of go out. And so 1940, they stopped mining. Then a company took over the town and they're like, you know, we're going to make this town work again. They had a caretaker in place. A couple years passed, they couldn't pay the caretaker. So in lieu of back wages, they actually just gave him the town. And so that's kind of when it transferred into individual ownership, just to kind of explain why I'm here as well. And then it kind of got passed from like family to family. And then in 2018, I was living in Austin, Texas, and I was working primarily in digital marketing. You know, I primarily worked with authors, so I'd help them work with their books and things. And then I also had a bed and breakfast on the side. And the bed and breakfast that I had in Austin was in a old Victorian mansion from the 1890s. And so I always liked this idea of history and hospitality. And so I was able to kind of leverage that building to end up buying the town in 2018, you know, with a loan and some chip-ins from some friends, bought that in 2018. Thought I was going to kind of be managing it from afar for a while. And then March 2020 hits, pandemic hits, everybody's trying to figure out where they're going to go. I move up to Cerro Gordo, deciding that this is going to be a great place to socially distance, and really just fell in love with the place, you know, really dove deep into the history, started understanding it more. And now we're sitting here almost 4 years to the date that I moved up here originally, still living here day to day. This is where I've lived. I don't have anything anywhere else anymore. I don't have an apartment in Austin like I used to. I don't have buildings there anymore. This is it. I kind of pushed all the chips in. And so I know that was kind of a long explanation of the background on Cerro Gordo and why I'm sitting at Cerro Gordo, I guess.
Wow, that's amazing. So what was the original, you bought it in 2018. Were you originally going to put like a tourist or like a hotel attraction, or what was the original plan?
Yes, the original idea was, yeah, some kind of a hospitality location. So it already had a hotel that we're going to use kind of as the centerpiece of people to gather in. And then we were going to put up a couple of cabins around town, you know, some campsites. The property is about 400 acres, so it's quite large. And so we had plenty of room to do that. That was the original plan. It's still the plan now. There's been some crazy journey within there. We actually lost the main hotel here to a fire about four years ago now. And that was devastating. That kind of like set back the whole plans. It was just kind of my hopes, dreams, and a lot of my life savings just kind of going up in smoke. And so over the past few years, a lot of the time up here has been rebuilding that, you know, and the kind of the journey of rebuilding this hotel. And like, how do you come back from getting punched in the gut when, you know, like everything kind of dissolves in front of you? But the plan is still that it's, we hope to open up the hotel this year. I'm looking out the window. If you see me keep looking out the window, it's because I look at it. I look at it hundreds of times a day because it's kind of like my baby at this point. It's like very precious to me. And so we're hoping to open up the hotel this year. And then maybe long-term we get back to opening up those cabins and campsites. So that way people can come and, I don't know, experience the history here and also just the natural beauty all around the town.
And it's winter there. So is there a lot of snow? Are you snowed in?
I'm not snowed in at the moment. I've been snowed in before. So the final 8 miles to get to town is a dirt road that increases a mile in elevation during those 8 miles. So it's a really, imagine like a very steep, very dirt, very cliffy mountain road. And that's kind of the final 8 miles. So if we do get a lot of snow, no one's plowing the road. So you're kind of stuck. But there is snow on the ground right now. It's melting. I'm watching it melt out the window, but not stuck at the moment, which is a good thing. But yeah, it can get really cold. It can get really cold in the winter.
I was reading your book and I think it said that you got snowed in like very early in your journey of like in like first like month of living there or something. Is that true?
Yeah, it was actually my first journey because March 2020, everybody's figuring out what's going to happen with this pandemic. You know, where are we going to go? What are we going to do? I pack up my truck in Austin because my bed and breakfast in Austin got shut down during the pandemic. You know, you're not having hospitality locations during the pandemic. So that gets shut down. I don't really have anything to do. Pack up my truck, come out here, and I didn't even make it all the way into town. You know, the very first night the snow was falling, but I couldn't see the snow from the bottom of the hill because it was nighttime. So I got about a quarter mile till town. My little truck that I brought from Austin was two-wheel drive, not nearly capable enough to get up here. Got snowed in, hiked into town, and kind of the adventure began. And it was it's been increasingly an adventure, I think, over the past 4 years, every month being here.
Yeah. How close is like the nearest, you know, town where you can kind of re-up on supplies and stuff?
Yeah, there's a town called Lone Pine, which is about, I would say, 45 minutes from here if you factor in the hill. It depends on how fast or slow you go up the hill. You know, the hill can take people an hour to come up this 8 miles, or it can take you 20 minutes if you've driven it a bunch like I have. But I would say 45 minutes an hour is Lone Pine, but that's just got a small market. If you want like a proper grocery store, it's Bishop or Ridgecrest, which are about hour and a half, 2 hours away basically.
So what are you doing when you go up there? Are you just bringing like a truckload of stuff? So you've got like, what, like a month of supplies or something?
Yeah, I try to like do one big shop. You know, if I can convince somebody else to do the shop for me, if they're coming to visit, for instance, I'm like, hey, you have a Costco membership. You know, why don't you stop by and buy me, you know, enough food for a month. I try to stock up pretty good because that first winter was a big learning experience. You know, I came up very transparently without nearly enough stuff. And so I ended up having to like scavenge some of the other cabins for old canned goods just to kind of get by that first winter. And so these days, yeah, I have five refrigerators that are very well stocked, you know, deep freezers and stuff. So that way I'm not in that situation again. But everything up here just takes a little bit more foresight and planning, I would say.
Were you, when you first got snowed in, were you eating like canned food from like the 1900s that you found or something?
It wasn't like quite from the turn of the century, but it was pretty old. It was definitely expired. You know, it was definitely one of those, you know, question, you're like, and you know, I called my sister, she's a nurse. I was like, can you eat expired food? She's like, well, it's not good to do that, but like, if you need to, I was like, yeah, that's fine. And so it was kind of a survival moment. I think I was looking for that in a way, you know, I was looking for an adventure. I was looking for something that was the opposite of kind of the comfortable life that I was living in Austin. And so I wanted that kind of, I had that like desire for an adventure. And I feel like the first night, not even getting all the way to town and getting stuck in the snow, it was like immediately into the adventure for me.
Yeah. Is there like a source of water in the town, or do you have to bring like loads and loads of thousands of gallons up with you? Or is there a source of water somewhere there?
Yeah, there's never been a very good source of water up here. You know, when the town is a booming mining town, they found two like really shallow wells around the town, but they tapped them within 2 or 3 years, they would drain them. And so the majority of the time they were bringing up on mules, just huge barrels of water all day. And like mining is really water intensive. So they're bringing up 40 or 50,000 gallons a day on mules, which is just crazy to think about.
Wow.
For me, I bring up the drinking water just in gallon jugs or 5 gallon jugs or something. But for other water, like washing dishes and stuff, I have like a really old military truck, one of the old 5-ton military trucks. And so I can go down to the bottom of the hill, and there's a little town called Keeler, and Keeler has zero commercial activity. It's just some smaller homes and trailers. And there's my buddy there has a well. So he lets me fill up about, you know, 500 or 600 gallons at a time in the back of the truck. And then I'll drive that up here and put it into storage tanks, basically.
Oh, cool. And so there's no actual running water on the property. So what do you do you have like a shower with like a handle that you pull?
Yeah. Like when I first got up here, it was have you ever seen those camping showers that you leave out in the sun for long enough and they hopefully get warm enough? And then it's basically essentially like it's a grocery bag that's sealed that has a thermometer on it that you put in the sun and hopefully it gets hot. And then you kind of hold it above your head to shower. And that was it for the first year. These days, I do have it plumbed in from the storage tank into one shower and bathroom here. So I can take a shower. I can use the bathroom in one of the houses. But that water is all coming from the water that I truck up from down below.
Yeah. Yeah. Got you. Yeah. I was recently down in Mexico, and I don't know if you've ever been down there. There's like the cenotes, which are like the natural kind of caves full of water. Yeah. But for some of them, you have to shower before you go down there. And they had like a, you know, it's like a big jug of water kind of up on a platform, and you pull the lever and like rinse off with the freezing cold water. So I was wondering if you had like a setup like that. A
similar experience here. Yeah. I went through various variations, you know, going from the bagged water to then like 5 gallon jugs, just kind of dumping them on my head to then like different things. But these days I feel like I'm in a much better place.
So other than like just renovation and building up the place, are there any kind of like interesting adventures that you end up going on while you're living up there?
Yeah, I think the biggest one is just the mines. You know, all the buildings above ground exist because of the mines below ground. And so there's about 30 miles of mines underneath the town, which is crazy to think about. And so the main shaft here goes 900 feet straight down. And off of that, there's branches. And when I first moved up here, the old owners were very against going in the mines, which makes a lot of sense. You gotta figure, these are mines from 150 years ago that were created using dynamite and old wood. And so they're not structurally sound. They're very dangerous. You know, those signs that they've put in front of mines, like stay out and stay alive, you know, it's like the signs in front of every single mine here. But eventually, like, it's the pandemic. I don't have a lot to do. Curiosity gets me, you know, I go 50 feet into one mine and I kind of turn around and run away. And then I go 100 feet into one. But the main thing that I got going was this main mine shaft that goes 900 feet down. It has a hoist at it. So imagine like a steel cage with a cable coming out the top, and like a giant winch over here that slowly lowers out the cable to lower down this cage into the mine. And it still existed, but the old owners weren't running it. They're like, no, it's dangerous down there. Don't go down there. That's like a bad idea. But after being up here long enough, I met a lot of guys in the surrounding area. And I think the desert's full of very high agency people, is what we'll say. You know, people that see a goal and like, they're like, no, we'll get the hoist working. Like, don't you worry. Like, you're going to go down in the mine if you want to go to the mine. And so the guy that owns the local auto parts store here, this guy named Dave. Dave's like, I can get it going for sure. And so, you know, we fixed up the hoist a little bit, added a new motor to it, just made it so that way we could like actually make it work. And I started going down in the main mine, which was really cool to me. You know, for somebody like, the appeal of this town to me is the history here. I think the history is very rich. And so to be able to read about, you know, this accident that happened at the 86th level of the mine, and then to be able to actually go down to the level of the mine, get off of the hoist and look around, was just like, it was game changing to me. It very much like provided that context that made me fall in love with the town that much more. Cause I think that, like, for instance, if you live in a town and you walk by a park every single day, And one day you decide, hey, I'm going to look up the history of that park. You know, the next time you walk by that park means a lot more to you. It just contextualizes everything. And so for me, like going into these mines, I was like, oh, now I get it. You know, now I understand why this whole town exists, because it's crazy down there. There's break rooms down there. There's huge dynamite vaults down there. There's areas where mules were stored in pens, you know, to move the ore around. There's ore carts down there. There's things called stopes. And stopes are essentially where they take out a large body of ore. And so there's stopes that are 90 feet tall. So imagine going into the basically an auditorium that's hundreds of feet underground. It's very crazy. And the more I spent down there, the more I understood the history. And I just like appreciated the time up here a lot more.
You ever find like any like human bones down there or anything?
I haven't found any human bones. I found some non-human bones, but the thing you're really looking for, like the thing that is every mine explorer's dream, is to find Levi jeans. And so the reason is that like Levi Strauss originally made the first pair of blue jeans as we know them for California silver miners in the 1870s. That's what the ones we know with the rivet, you know, denim existed beforehand, but jeans as we understand them now were invented for California silver miners. And so if you can find a pair of original, you know, 1870s Levi jeans to the right collector, those are worth six figures. You know, I saw a pair that sold not too long ago for like $140,000. And so
I've heard of this. You find like an old, like faded pair of Levi's down the mine and you'll get like $100,000 for it. I've heard of that.
Yeah. And there's people whose entire career is just hunting for Levi jeans, which is a whole other tangent. There's a guy named Britt Eaton. Actually, he's a friend of mine now, but he goes as like Indiana Jeans, I think is his like social media handle. And his whole thing is just finding old jeans. And so I'm always looking for those, you know, there's always like the allure, it's not even necessarily the monetary value. It's the idea that they're so rare, you know, the one it's representing. And they found some here before, you know, the old owner had found six or eight pairs.
Oh, wow.
Kind of a beautiful story. He ended up having to sell them to pay for his wife's chemotherapy. She got cancer eventually. Mm-hmm. So none are still here, but yeah, I'm always like scraps of denim. I was very excited about, you know, I'd be going like, oh, is that denim? And pretty quickly I would realize, you know, down in the mine, you have to figure these guys are working 12-hour shifts. You know, they're down there for 12 hours, usually at a time. 12 hours is a long time. And so when you find these little scraps of denim, which I thought was so cool, because like, oh, well, it's history. Usually that's because they were cutting them into squares to use them as toilet paper. So it's a little less alluring when you find the little scraps after you kind of put it together, like, oh, 12 hours down in the mine. There's probably somewhere where they're using the restroom. And so, yeah.
And have you found little scraps of denim?
Oh, tons. Yeah. A bunch. And usually it's at an end of an adit. So basically like at the end of a tunnel that they weren't using anymore. Usually what you'll find is you'll find a bunch of dynamite boxes all stacked up next to each other. And then 150 years later, essentially what looks like dirt and then a lot of carbide tins. And so carbide is basically the mineral that they would burn in their headlamp to make the lamp go is carbide. And so when it's ashed, it just becomes into like an ash, you know, it becomes like a charcoal base almost. And so you'll see a lot of carbide covering up a lot of what looks like dirt inside of dynamite boxes, but that was essentially their restrooms that you stumble upon occasionally.
Oh, wow. And so are you finding like unused dynamite as well?
Yeah. A lot of dynamite, which is terrifying because nitroglycerin, which is like the stable ingredient, it was the active ingredient in dynamite. Essentially it bleeds out over time. So dynamite is nitroglycerin with some like dichotomous earth or whatever to keep it stable. But over time, the nitroglycerin can bleed out to the surface and create crystals. And the crystals are no longer in that clay. So they're very, very unstable. So even to the point where a heavy footstep could like essentially ignite this dynamite.
That's what I was just thinking. I was like, oh my God, you could like step on a crystal and blow the place.
Yeah. And so you pretty quickly learn to like give dynamite its respect when you're down in the mines, you know? And so I go pretty far around it all. But yeah, there's whole rooms down there. Usually it's really cool. Like you'll come upon, they've made a tunnel into a room and the door will be like double padlock. And it'll say like almost out of a movie, it'll say danger, high explosives, you know, on the door. And then if you were to go into the door, I remember one of my very first explorations, I was down there with a buddy of mine and I turned this corner and I saw this door that said danger, high explosives. And I was like, oh man, this is going to be it. And I kind of turned the corner and inside of the door, laying kind of against the wall, was this really cool leather backpack And I was like, oh, wow, that's cool. And like, I peeked in the backpack and it was just stuffed with dynamite, you know, just like to the brim with dynamite. And a buddy of mine, the guy that I was with, came around the corner. And I was like, dude, look at this dynamite, or look at this backpack. And he's like, oh, cool. And he just picks it up and dumps out the dynamite. And I was like, oh my God. Like, and luckily that level of the mine was fairly damp. And so like, it kind of got neutralized over the years, but like, that could have been the end of the entire experience right there.
Oh my God. Yeah. You got it. When you go with a friend, you gotta be like, no smoking in the mine. I imagine back in the 1800s, people were smoking down there.
I mean, yeah, I would say the most common thing that I find are the Prince Albert cans. You know, Prince Albert tobacco used to come in these cans. Uh-huh. And so I find so many Prince Albert cans just thrown to the side. And what they would do a lot of times is after the miners were done smoking the tobacco in them, they would use it as like a personal can of that carbide, that stuff that would keep their lamp going. So now a lot of times you'll open it up and it'll be full of like what looks like chalk these days, but it'll be full of carbide down there.
Oh, like unburned?
Yeah. Yeah.
So like if their lamp starts going dim, they have more to.
Yeah, they have a little personal supply on them.
That's so cool. All the history down there, like the denim, the tobacco tins.
Yeah.
I wonder what the age of like the average worker was down there.
So the census has some, you know, reports from here, but a lot of the miners that were here were Chinese miners, and they're primarily a lot of times undocumented. But from the reports I can see, I would say like early 20s to early 30s. If you're mid 30s and in a mine, you're like an old timer, you know, you're lucky to be alive basically. And so I would say early 20s to early 30s. I haven't found reports of like child miners. You know, that was the case in some of the different mines, but from my deep research, I haven't found that. It could have been the case, but they just didn't report it. But from the photos and the articles I've read, I've never found any reports of that. But I would say, yeah, that's kind of the range that most of the miners would be.
Yeah. And I think it was in the book. I've been reading your book. I haven't finished it yet, but I think it was in the book that it said there was like one murder per week reported there.
Yeah. It was a dangerous town. You know, it was very far removed, and the law essentially wanted them to figure things out themselves. They didn't want to come up here. They didn't want to go up the 8-mile dirt road. And so shootouts were really common. There's actually a cemetery here that I can see right out my window right now. And in the cemetery, there's somewhere between, the estimates are around maybe 400 to 500 miners that are in the cemetery. And so basically, it's a very dangerous town. You know, you figure these miners were far away from their families. They were working 12-hour shifts. When they got out of the shifts, there were bars that were open 24 hours a day. There was brothels that were open 24 hours a day. There wasn't a lot to do but drink and get in arguments. And so there's a lot of shooting happening here. It's an extraordinarily dangerous profession to begin with. You know, the mining, there's a lot of very famous mining accidents here. Like in the 1870s, in 1871, there's an accident on the 200 level of the mine, where essentially they overstoped, and overstoping means you take out too much of the ceiling above you to make the rock a little brittle, and it collapsed on the miners and it killed 30 miners. And there's actually so much material on top of them, they were never able to get them out. And so it's kind of haunting thinking that, you know, they're still there. You know, like when I go down past the 200, that there's still 30 miners buried, you know, a couple hundred feet over to the left or whatever.
Yeah. Wow. So when you go down the 900-foot shaft, is that just like straight down on an open elevator?
Yeah. It's like an open elevator, kind of like a cage. It's slowly lowering down. And it's slow. You know, when we fix it up to get it going again, we put a new motor on it. And so it goes a lot slower than it did back in the day. So these days, if I want to go down to the 900 level, it takes about 45 minutes, I would say, to get down there. So you got a lot of time to look over the edge and just watch or see how far as you can into the darkness and just think about how big a drop is below you the entire time.
And you probably can't see too far down, huh?
Not too much. I eventually ran like a rope light all the way down to at least set a little bit of like mood lighting or something to make it a little less grim going down there. But the first time we went down, the difficulty was the guide rails, basically the things that make sure that the cage doesn't spin in a circle, they had warped over time. And so the cage couldn't even go all the way past some of the levels, you know, it would get stuck. And so I had a guy with me named Craig. And so what Craig would do is he would harness himself in, dangle below the cage, you know, with a full exposure below him, and then sawzall out the back of the guide rail so we can push it back so the cage can pass it. And so the first trip down was it almost felt like we were going to the moon or something, you know, because nobody had been out there for so long, and we were going 10 feet at a time, pushing back the guide rail, dangling underneath the cage, doing all these things. But these days it works a little bit better. Actually, recently, I ran power all the way down to the 900 level. And also I ran internet through this strange, you know, mix of design that my buddy produced for me. And so when it came time to record my book, you know, I had to do an audiobook version. I actually recorded the audiobook down at the 900 foot level of the mine, which is kind of like fun tie-in for the book. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was fun.
So when you go down there, you're going down on like 150 foot lift. Or yeah. Sorry, 150
year old
lift.
Yeah. And it's got a cable above it. And I think the most common question I get asked is, what is the, you know, weight capacity of the cable? And it's just an answer I don't really want to know the answer to. You know, I was like, I don't know. They're like, when is it from? I was like, I don't know.
And the cable is that old too, huh?
Yeah, the cable, the cage, the everything except for the motor that operates the hoist was really old.
How many people do you think they used to pile into that?
So that there's signs on most of the levels that say like three people max. They want to keep it down to three, but it used to have to haul a lot of weight because galena, the mineral that they're mining, is lead and silver. So it's very dense. It's very heavy. And so with the ore carts, a lot of times they would, you know, bring the ore carts to the cage, put it in the cage, and then the ore cart would go up by itself. And so you have to figure it has to be able to lift a lot of weight. But we did overload it one time, which was very scary. I was here and I have a couple of friends that have a TV show called the Diesel Brothers, and they're like diesel mechanics. And so they came and they wanted to go down to the 900 foot level. And they're actually the ones that gave me the military truck I mentioned. So I was like, yeah, sure. Like, let's go down there. And we went down and they're two big guys. And then we found an ore cart down there, like an old ore cart with actually like the metal cart that they pushed the ore around in, which must've weighed a couple hundred pounds. And then we found this old jack that was huge. It must've weighed, you know, 300 or 400 pounds itself. And then we found a bunch of galena and we started just piling all these cool treasures that we thought were great in the cage. And when we got back to the 700 foot level or close to it, the cage actually couldn't handle all the weight. So we actually had to get out of the hoist, climb against the rafters on the side of the shaft to the 700 foot level, and then let the cage kind of pass the tight spot by itself, which was terrifying.
Wait, you climbed up for how many?
Yeah, up the shaft.
For a couple hundred feet?
No, we only had to go up like maybe 30 feet to get to the level we were going to, but it was a scary 30 feet to just be kind of free climbing with, you know, a couple hundred foot drop below you.
Yeah. How are you climbing? Cause it's a straight vertical shaft, right?
Every like 6 or 8 feet, they would put timbers all around the shaft, kind of like square timbers to hold back the rock basically.
Yeah.
So you can kind of climb from timber to timber to timber if you're going up.
Okay. So it's kind of like a very spaced out ladder?
Yeah, exactly. A very spaced out ladder that's made of, you know, 150-year-old wood with square nails in it. So it's not the most trustworthy thing, but it's pretty fun.
And you're not harnessed in or anything. You're just free.
So I have rappelled down to the 900 by myself. So I've used rope to get all the way down because I wanted to be able to go down there without using the hoist, because the hoist is a bit of a production to use. You know, you have to figure, you have to have somebody running it the whole time. You have to have a spotter over the hole looking down. You have to have somebody yelling in between the two because it's very loud. And so I have to convince basically three friends to spend the majority of their day just letting me down into the mine, which is hard to do sometimes. And so
is that like one's got to be up top, one's got to be with you, and then like a third is just like watching the whole thing?
Yeah, well, the whole time that it's going down, someone's got to be controlling the cable down. So someone's controlling the cable down, somebody's watching the cage to make sure that it doesn't get stuck, you know, some issue happens, which has happened also. And then one is usually just the roaming around yelling, and then probably one to go down there with me.
Yeah.
And so to ease that, I have a rope that goes down to the 900, but then going down 900 feet of rope, once you get over the anxiety of it, it's fun. You know, you're kind of having a good time. It's the going back up 900 feet of rope, which is no fun at all. Very, very annoying.
It's gotta be very tiring.
Really? Yeah. I remember last time I was down there, I was pushing myself as fast as I could go, you know, and I'm just like, I'm used to wandering around. I'm in good, cardiovascular health after being up here for a while, but like it took me, I think, like 3.5 hours or something to get up the rope.
Wow.
Just a constant, just like climbing, dangling, waiting for you to catch your breath while you're like feeling yourself dangle in this void and then keep climbing up.
Is the 900 foot shaft the only way in and out of the mine?
These days it is. Yeah. There used to be portals to the outside, but they've collapsed over the years. And I've tried digging them out many times with like excavators and stuff. I just can't get a lot of the rock here is like what they call like country rock, is really brittle. And so not great to think about when you're down there, you know, shuffling through some old collapses. But yeah, right now the only way in and out is the 900 foot shaft, which in some ways is good because nobody can just kind of sneak up and go into the mine. You know, I know who's in the, I know who's, you cannot, you basically can't get in there, you know, without me knowing about it.
Yeah. It could be very dangerous for someone to go in there unknown.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel like you've explored the whole thing, or do you think there's more to find that you don't know about yet?
I think there's still a lot more because, you know, let's say that there's a vertical shaft and I access it from the main mine here and then I go out. If there's a collapse here, there might be a couple miles of mine behind the collapse.
Yeah.
And so right now my big adventure is trying to clear some of these collapses, which is about as dangerous as it gets when you're in an abandoned mine to be digging out rock from 150 years ago. But it's interesting to me because, for instance, the 900 foot is the end of the cage, but I was reading this really obscure prospectus that was from the late 1800s. And it mentioned that there's actually five more levels below the 900 foot level, not where the cage goes. But if you go over about a quarter of a mile, there's another hoist system that goes down to these other five levels. And these five levels are not talked about essentially anywhere but this prospectus. And there's a couple more, like many miles of mines. And these are mines that nobody has been into for hundreds of years. And so that allure of like, what's there, like discovering new history, is right now I've been working for about 4 months of getting past the collapse that would lead me to that second hoist. It's slow going. I try to be careful with it, but you know, if we are able to get down there, who knows, maybe, hey, maybe that's where the 10 pairs of Levi jeans are or something, you know?
I was just going to say, I hope you find like a stack of jeans down there and like, you know, a couple, maybe some denim jackets.
Yeah.
Get a whole wardrobe.
Yeah, a whole wardrobe.
Yeah. I hope you do find some denim jeans because I just feel like the history in that and the story is so amazing. So yeah. I hope you find at least a couple pairs once you open up more sections.
Thank you.
What is it like? What does it feel like down there? Is it like sweltering hot or?
It's always about the same temperature, which is interesting. I think it's always probably, if I had to guess, like 60 to 62 ish.
Yeah. Okay.
But year round. So like in the winter, for instance, so last month I went down to the 900 to record the audiobook and it was blizzarding on the surface. So it was very cold. We're talking in the teens. So down there, it was almost like a break. It's like, oh, it's so warm down here. It was nice to kind of have the insulation of the earth to kind of keep it warm down there. And I actually set up like a bedroom down there. I have like a mattress down there. I have like a little kitchen down there. I have like a desk that I built to record the audiobook. So I have my, you know, escape shelter 900 feet underground, I guess.
And did you take all that stuff down just using the hoist?
Yeah. Yeah. I packed the hoist so tight I had to ride on top of the cage, you know, which was a little sketchy. And so I had all my cargo in there and I brought it down. But it's very like the mine can be really disorienting because it's quieter and darker than anything else that I've ever been into. You can't like imagine there's not even the idea of light when you're down there, you know, especially if you go off of the main shaft and you go over a little bit, there's no light, there's no noise, there's no animals that far down. There's nothing for them to eat. So there's no, outside of a bat, you know, if you're in the upper levels, there's some bats that can be interesting. But they're usually migratory and they're like hibernating. So they don't want to go 900 feet down. They'll just go, you know, to the 200 level or something and hang out there. So 900 feet down, it's like, if you turn off your headlamp, which I like to do just because it freaks me out, it's just like so dark, so quiet. And just, I remember one time I spent 2 days down there straight just to see what would happen. And I started having the like auditory hallucinations where I would hear almost like crowds and stuff.
Whoa.
Cause I was down there by myself. There was nobody else there. And I just wanted to like, I don't know. It was like during the winter and it was snowing. I was like, well, I don't know, I'll go down to the mine for a couple of days. And it was crazy.
Kind of an experiment in solitude.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, than just being in the town originally, you know?
Yeah. Now I'm wondering, was the auditory hallucinations, is that the ghosts?
Yeah. I mean, maybe. Yeah, there was a lot of people died in the mine, you know, a lot of people are still in the mine.
Yeah.
And so like, who knows? I think that I feel like the paranormal element in me have come to terms. I don't really have any ghost experiences anymore. I think when I first moved up here, I had a few that I didn't really like very much. And so say that either we're both becoming more comfortable with each other, or I'm just becoming more comfortable with the sights and sounds that I interpreted as ghosts initially. But yeah.
So when you first arrived, there was some something that seemed paranormal going on?
Yeah, there's kind of one main incident that threw me off a little bit. And this is actually before I lived here full time. This is back when I was flying in and out, and we had a caretaker that was living here named Robert. And we had some contractors that were working on one of the cabins. And there's a building on the north side of the property called the bunkhouse. And the bunkhouse is right before this overlook that overlooks the Sierra Nevada. And so I always walked by it to go watch the sunset every night. And I remember one night I had just flown into town. Robert was here. And so I was walking by and somebody was in the kitchen of the bunkhouse. And so they kind of like looked out the window, looked at me, and the light was on, and they kind of closed the curtain. I was like, oh, that's weird. I thought like Robert would tell me that somebody was in the bunkhouse, but I didn't think too much of it because sometimes contractors would stay there or friends and stuff. So I kind of like went about my day and I walked up to the ridge and I watched the sunset, walked back by, light still in the kitchen, go back to my cabin, hang out. And then in the morning, Robert kind of came up to talk, have coffee or whatever. And I was like, hey, how long are the contractors staying in the bunkhouse? I remember that he kind of like got really quiet. He was like, they left like 4 weeks ago, you know? And my heart dropped because I'm a pretty rational person. And I know that I saw somebody in there. And this isn't, again, we're at the end of an 8-mile dirt road. So there's not just a person didn't just stop by to look in there. Like we have a sensor on the road. So if a car comes up the road, I know the car is coming about a half mile before it gets here.
Yeah.
And so then my mind starts racing. I was like, okay, what did you see? How did you see it? You know? And so I remember I went down to the bunkhouse with a lock, with the intention of locking it, and just walking through it. And it's kind of a very long hallway with three rooms on either side. So imagine a long hallway, two rooms. I remember like, as I was walking towards the back, I never had the feeling that you shouldn't be somewhere more than that. It was like that feeling is like, get out of here. Like it was like overwhelming. And it was probably me out on edge basically. But I remember I went back to the kitchen. I turned off the light, and it was one of these like screw lights where you have to like twist a knob to turn it off. So I turned off the light. I went back and like, I padlocked the door. I was like, no, I'm not dealing with that anymore. And so I forgot about it. I was like, oh, whatever. And then that night I went back to watch the sunset again. And I go back to walk by the bunkhouse again, and the kitchen light is back on. And I was like, oh, come on. And like,
this is after you padlocked it shut.
This is after I padlocked it. This is after I was the only one with the key, after I turned off the light, and after what I had seen the day before. And I couldn't rationalize my way out of it. You know, at that point I was just like, no, there's no other input other than me. And so at this point I handled it for the longest time. I just didn't go to the bunkhouse. I was like, I'm just not going down there. I'm just leaving. We have about 22 buildings here. I was like, you know, there's plenty of other buildings to go to. And so that was like the main incident. There's been a lot of visitors that have seen a lot of other stuff. There's some like famous ghosts up here, I guess, that other people have seen regularly, but okay. That was kind of my one and only story that happened even before I moved here.
Now, has Robert the caretaker seen the same ghost, or did you have a conversation with him about this?
I told him, but he usually saw a different one. There was a guy named William Crapo that lived up here. And so William Crapo was the former postmaster of the town, and he used to live in the cabin directly next to the hotel. And then he lost office. He wasn't in office anymore. And there was another guy named Henry Boland that kind of started strolling down the town, and him and Crapo got into this argument. And then Crapo ended up shooting and killing Boland right outside the hotel. And it was a very publicized murder. You know, it was in all the newspapers. The governor of California actually came to offer, like, I think it was a $500 reward to find Crapo. And Crapo disappeared. And they said that he went into a mine shaft and was never seen again. So that was the big, you know, and they never found Crapo, William Crapo. He was never found again. And so Robert's go-to guy that he would see would be William Crapo somewhere around the hotel. You know, typically in the back window, there used to be a screen. And he said that a lot of times when his cabin was closest to the hotel, he would look in the back screen and he would see what he described as kind of, there's this tobacco brand called the Zigzag Tobacco. And like, he says that the logo of that tobacco is like what he would see in the back of the window so often.
That's like the guy with like, kind of like the mustache.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and is that what William Crapo looked like? Is there a photograph of him, like a historical photo of him somewhere?
That's the tough part. There's not a historical photograph. There is a description of him, and they describe him, but a lot of miners kind of looked like that, you know? And so it's tough. It's like, you know, rough looking guy, certain height, you know, medium build, whatever. Yeah. There is a description of him that way, but that was Robert's main one. And then the other one that people talk about a lot when they're up here, a lot of people see the woman in the black dress is what people describe it as. And I have not encountered her yet. I would be loved to, but essentially, like, my friend Craig that I actually mentioned went down in the hoist with me and cut out the shaft to help us get the cage passed. He was the most recent one. And he was in the bunkhouse, and he was looking over towards the old church, and he saw this woman in the black dress, like standing outside of the front door, and kind of like waved to him and then went into the church. And Craig is also another guy, like, he's a straight shooter. He's an electrician. He works for the Department of Water and Power. He's not bullshitting around. And so that was like, whoa. And before that, a bunch of other people are described as similar lady in the streets here. And if we have to attach it to somebody from the history here, the closest it would be, there was a woman that lived here named Lola Travis, and she owned the brothels in town. Uh-huh. And so one of the main brothels was called Lola's Palace of Pleasure, which is actually still partially standing. But she also owned brothels in Lone Pine, in another town called Darwin, and another town called Panamint City. But so she was she was a successful entrepreneur, you know, is the only way to kind of describe it, back in the 1800s. But there's some people like to connect those two together, that Lola is the woman in the black dress that's kind of stalking around Cerro Gordo still.
Yeah, I wonder if she had some sort of, like, was she killed, or did she have some kind of like dramatic death?
Yeah, I don't know about her death. I do know that there's a story where she was in Darwin, which is another neighboring mining town. And then I guess there's an argument outside the brothel about payment. Basically, a miner didn't want to pay for whatever service was rendered. And so she, from the story that I read, shot him dead in the street in the middle of Darwin, and nobody ever tried her. There was never brought to trial. There was like, yep, that's his Lola. So she was a very like protective and harsh person. So I could imagine that she was involved with some incidents that maybe, you know, haunt the afterlife in some way.
Yeah. And now she just feels like she wants to keep an eye on things too.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't put that together. Yeah. Maybe she's more the protector ghost. You know, she's just keeping an eye on things. Yeah.
They all seem pretty nice though. Like, you don't have any stories of them like messing with you or messing with people at all.
No, the only ones I've heard of, like, some mischief, I guess, people like moving items and things like that. I've heard from other guests that have stayed here, but nobody like, you know, like terrifying them in the middle of the night. I think it's more of a curiosity as far as I've heard.
Okay. They're just like, what are people doing back here? It's been a while.
Yeah. Can I join?
Yeah. Yeah. Welcome. Yeah. So as you renovate the place, do you plan to keep most of the original buildings in the places that they are and just like renovate them and keep them true to history? Or are you going to knock buildings down, or what's the plan with that?
Yeah. Keep every building that's standing where it is. And ideally add back buildings where they used to be as well. You know, because the pads are still visible. Like, if I look out my window, I see some stone cribbing, so some stacked stones in a flat area. And luckily, Cerro Gordo was such an important mining town back in the day that there's a lot of photographs. And so if I choose to rebuild some of the buildings long-term, I'd love to like make them at least look similar to what they might have back in the day. Obviously, these days we have to abide by modern building codes and all that type of stuff, so it's a lot different. But yeah, the idea is renovate the buildings that are here, you know, maybe repurpose them so they're useful these days. So for instance, right now, what used to be a mechanics garage, the old owners made into a movie theater. And now we're kind of finishing the movie theater to have a place to show films and stuff. Cool. And there's another old cabin that's from the 1890s that we're making into a recording studio, you know, so maybe some musicians can come up and record some music if they want to.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. That's really cool. Do you ever, I just have so many questions about the mine as well. Do you ever bring like a bolt cutter down there? Cause you said you get down there and there's like some padlocked rooms. So are you just like blasting doors open, or can you talk about that?
Sometimes bring, usually the wood has gotten so deteriorated that I can just bring a hammer and almost rip the lock off, you know, the lock off of the wood. But usually I'm bringing a few things. I usually bring like a rock hammer so I can break some rocks off. Cause there's also outside of the galena, which there's still, that's the silver and lead ore, and there's still some in the mine. There's also just some really beautiful minerals down there. Like, there's naturally occurring turquoise on the property. There's a thing called smithsonite, which is like a really cool opaque blue. And we have a bunch of just stuff like that. So I'm always like rock hounding a little bit too. I usually bring what's called like a four gas monitor, cause old mines kind of have like bad air in them. And so it can be really dangerous. Like, it'll just pass out and die, you know, pretty much immediately. And so I bring one that if it detects any of that bad gas or the oxygen is running low, it starts yelling at me. It'll literally just like start like sirening and basically say, turn around. And so I bring that a lot of times. I usually bring a harness and some type of rope if I do need to go down some type of incline. And usually a backpack for whatever I find. Cause I, every time you're down there, whether you've gone down the same mine shaft a bunch of times, you're always finding something new, whether it's another Prince Albert can or, you know, another old hammer or chisel or something like that. There's always things. And then in town, speaking of repurposing some of the buildings, the old general store here, I've made into a museum. And so anything that I find down in the mines, I put in the museum here. And that's kind of nice. A fun thing to do too.
That's very cool. What are some of your favorite things that you have found down there?
Yeah, I think, you know, I have found a pair of Levi's. They were just shredded and destroyed. They're on a very wet level. So they're very deteriorating. But yeah. When I zoomed in on the button, it said Levi Strauss & Co., you know, so I was like, yes, you know, it was more just like a personal victory after looking for them for so long.
Yeah.
And so that was like fun because I knew the history, that like brought the history to life. I was like, oh, and it was like, okay, these are actually here. If you can find a pair that isn't, you know, deteriorated to crap, then maybe, you know, it's worth something. But what probably my favorite finds is I like things that humanize the history a little bit. So for instance, I think that's why the jeans go for a lot too. Cause like the people like to see like a little drip of wax because then it's like, oh, like a guy was wearing this, you know, 150 years ago. And so two things that I found related to that was one time in the mine, I found a Prince Albert can that was at the bottom of this ladder that was up, that was raising up to a different part of the mine. And basically they were using this Prince Albert can as like their messenger. So the two miners were writing messages back to each other. This is about stuff like lunch, you know, like when do you want to go to lunch and stuff? And it's like throwing it down the shaft to the other person. And like, it was buried underneath some dirt, but I thought that was like really cool. Cause again, like then I was like, oh, these were like dudes that were hungry. You know, they're working. It just like brought it all to life a lot more for me.
Were there notes in the can that said, yeah, like, in the can. When's lunch today?
Yeah. Yeah. It was more, I think it says something about like lunch and then there's like a time. And it was almost like, it wasn't a check yes or no, but it was like they had their own symbols that were like, you know, they're talking back to each other and you could tell that like they knew what they're talking about. And I could tell that they're somehow deciding on when they would go to lunch.
That's
and
that was awesome.
Like really cool to me. And then that's in the museum. And then the other thing that I found, and this wasn't in the mine, but this was actually in the museum. I found an old briefcase, and in the briefcase, there was essentially every part of an old miner's life. You know, there was, there was love letters and then divorce settlements, you know, then there was like mining claims and bankruptcy lawsuits. And so, and there's pay stubs and all these different things. So you could kind of piece together a composite of not just that miner, but like every miner that was up here. Cause this wasn't one of the, there was famous people. There was like famous in the town people, you know, the owners, the main foremen and stuff like that. But this was a guy that wasn't written about in any of the history books. It was just a guy that his pay stubs would say like $4.17 and stuff. And so this wasn't a rich miner, but you kind of piece together why he was there and like the struggle he was going for. Cause he seemed to live here for almost 15 years and he never made a lot of money, but he was always trying and he was always dreaming of like a better future. It seemed like there was letters back home that were complaining about the long winters, but then, you know, the next one would be a letter back about trying to sell his ore to somebody and they wouldn't want to buy the ore. And he would basically be like trying to negotiate the spot price of what they were going to sell the ore for. It's like, it seemed like he had a lot of like hope and dream, which is, I think, brings a lot of people to the West and to mining towns. That's probably what brought me here too. You know, he saw more in the town than was currently here. And he saw more in himself than was currently being, you know, utilized. And I thought that was very like beautiful to kind of like see his thing laid out, but it was also like motivating in a way where, you know, this guy lived probably a very rich life. And at the end, all that's left is a couple pieces of paper, you know? And so it's kind of like motivating, like, okay, like what's going to be in your briefcase when you're dead? Like, what are your couple pieces of paper going to be? And so I remember finding that pretty early on here. And I was like, oh, I resonate with this guy because I can tell that he's like excited to be here and he's feels like he's doing a purpose of being here. But I could also tell like through his struggles and everything else that it wasn't working out as he planned, but he still seemed to love the process. And it was kind of a good moment to find it pretty early on.
It's such an amazing like Americana story of anyone that goes out to the West.
Yeah.
Like coming out here, trying to make it big and then like the ups and downs and the twists and turns. You could like put another book together just based off of the stuff in the briefcase.
Yeah. I'd actually love to. Like it. His name was Chet Reynolds. And like, so Chet is a very interesting guy. And I love I've tried to like find his family, you know, maybe get some of these documents back to them. Maybe they could fill in the blanks a little bit more, But for right now, I just kind of use him as a composite. So when I think about a miner, I think about, I don't know, I have no idea what he looks like, but like, I think I know Chet, you know, or at least his hopes and dreams a little bit. So he's kind of like a useful companion sometimes.
I hope you will find Chet's Levi's jeans next.
Yes, yes, yes.
I wonder though, why would someone bring their briefcase down in the mine that had all their stuff? Is it like maybe he didn't want to leave it up at, near his bunk and get all his pay stubs found? Or like,
The briefcase actually found in the general store. So it wasn't in the mine. It was in the general store. And it was probably my third week here. I decided to clean up the general store to make it usable for a museum. And it was kind of wrapped in a blanket tucked underneath one of the counters. And so this was up here, which I thought was really cool.
That's very interesting. So much cool history there. You know, another thing that's popping into my mind is, why would people leave their jeans down in the mine? Like, yeah. How does that happen?
Yeah. I wonder that too. I was like, why are there so many jeans? And so I guess the jeans were, it was a company town, right? So the jeans were actually they're seen as work pants. So they're actually property a lot of times of the mine, not of the miners. And there would be changing rooms down in the mines. So the miners would go down to work, change into their work wear. When their 12-hour shift was done, they would probably have to share their work pants with another miner, you know? So they would take off their work pants. And then when the mine went bust, who's thinking, like, if you had a pair of jeans from, let's say, you know, 2017, you're not going to be like, well, one day these are going to be valuable. You're like, no, these are like gross old jeans. I'm just leaving them down in the mine. And so they just discarded them. And so I've heard of people finding changing rooms with just, you know, dozens of pairs of pants in them and stuff like that.
I get that. Yeah. And especially you're like, I'm not going to go back down there to grab my uniform.
Yeah, like, exactly.
You know, why would I? It's like if I worked, like when I was much younger, I worked at like a service station, like a mechanics. I'm like, when I resigned, I'm like not going back for like my shirt or, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Interesting. So your book is coming out on the 19th.
Yep.
Can you tell me a little bit about the book, the writing process, and what it's about? And you mentioned that you did the audio book on the 900 level. So can you share a little bit about the book with the audience?
Yeah, the book's called Ghost Town Living. And that's kind of the same name as, I have a YouTube channel where I document a lot of the adventures up here too. So if you're interested in the kind of the progress of the town, that's in there. But the book's about the experience living up here for the last 4 years. And I tried to weave in throughout it, both history of the town, you know, so not just pulling off of my experiences here, but the experiences of the miners and the owners that lived here before. And then at the end, kind of pulling out the lesson that I got from each of those experiences. And so it goes through, you know, when we had a fire here and how I was kind of able to come back off of that. And like how I kind of went from living in Austin, living a comfortably numb existence, I would call it. You know, I had a good job, I had a nice apartment, but I felt like there was more there, you know, that I wanted this life of adventure. I wanted to kind of like lean into life a little bit more, and the kind of the process of finding that purpose through that, you know, adventure, and then now gaining all the new skills and everything like that. And so the book is about the 4 years here, but it's also about, you know, the mental journey that I've been on as well, but again, tied to the historic stories about the town. And so I think if you love adventure, there's some crazy stories in it that we've gotten into. If you love history, there's some amazing history of the town and how it played in California history. And then there's also, again, kind of the meditation at the end of what it means to me to have been through those experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. And you seem like very happy, you know, I think there's a lot of people in society today who just have like a 9-to-5 and they're just kind of bored with it. And you seem like very into like the history and the stories and the constant every day must be an adventure out there. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. It's just, it's kind of like grabbed my attention and not let go. It's how I feel about it. It's one of these places where I was always searching for something. You know, I felt like in Austin when I was living that life that I had some potential that wasn't being utilized, that there must be more out there. And I feel like it's like a feeling that a lot of people want. And I almost wanted that hard experience. I wanted something to be difficult in a really like raw and meaningful way. And I wanted to build something real in the real world. You know, I had been working in digital marketing for so long, which is satisfying in some way, but sometimes you want to like touch things. You want to see things that you built, like standing in front of you. That's why I keep, again, looking out the window at the hotel. And so I think that this was kind of a journey of finding the satisfaction within that, and just getting into the arena is the only way to kind of think of describe it, you know, just like finally participating in everything.
Yeah. And I did get a copy of the book. I have my copy right here.
Nice.
Ghost Town Living. And I haven't finished it yet, but I'm really enjoying it. It's kind of like, I like the combination of history and adventure that you've kind of woven in. And I haven't gotten to the end, but I'm actually really excited now that you mentioned there's like a meditation at the end on kind of your thoughts on the whole adventure. I'm excited to get to that part too.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm actually curious. You mentioned that there was a big fire kind of in the beginning that burned down the hotel. Mm-hmm. What happened there? What caused the fire and how did that all go down?
Yeah, it was, so the main hotel here was called the American Hotel. And it was just this beautiful hotel from 1871. And it was kind of the centerpiece of all the plans here. That was the gathering point. That was the picture spot. That was everything. And we lost it in July of 2020 to an electrical fire. And so we had an electrical fire that took it and one building next to it. And I remember the day after the fire, the old caretaker had come up the day before. So he was here. Two of my friends were here. And it was just like the most gut-wrenching thing you can imagine. You know, it was just like watching your hopes, dreams, life savings, everything kind of go up in flames. And I remember looking at it and I was kind of figuring out what to do next. You know, the options were I could go back to Austin, you know, put my tail between my legs, figure out the next project, or kind of double down. And I remember the old owner of the property had heard about a fire and he had raced up here and he actually saw me on my balcony and just kind of looking at the smoldering embers and stuff. And he came over to me and I remember, I thought he was going to be like upset that this happened on my watch or all of these different emotions were going through my head. And I remember he kind of looked at me and he goes, you know, there's not a lot you can do about this. This is going to meant to happen. I remember he said, it's history now and you can't change what happens, but what happens from here is up to you. And like those words were ones that like I really held on to, you know. I was thinking about like, you know, I think in tough moments, you're looking for something to hold on to. And the idea that like what happens next is up to you is a very like powerful statement in moments like that. And so yeah. I kind of used that to be like, oh yeah, he's right. You know, like in 20 years, there's been four huge fires at Cerro Gordo over its history. That'll just be the fire of, sorry. That'll just be, you know, the fire of 2020. And so the thinking about it in that long-term perspective of decades and stuff. And so it's kind of been the main project over the last 4 years for me is like rebuilding it, which has just been at times impossibly difficult. Because again, we're at the end of an 8-mile dirt road and we're trying to build a hotel that meets modern building code, but still looks old. And so that's just a very difficult equation. But I think that through that, I feel like a lot more capable of everything. Like if I can rebuild a hotel in the middle of nowhere on top of a mountain, like what can't we do here? So it's kind of given me a lot of confidence in my abilities and like a lot of agency in like what we're doing up here.
Yeah. Amazing. And I think the words from the previous owner are very wise. And that's just, I feel like those wise words are also very generous of him because I try to put myself in your shoes and I kind of like you said, I'd be like, oh God, like this guy's going to be really mad at me. And I think that's really kind of him that he wasn't like, you know, it's not your fault, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think like any time in moments where like people could be angry and they show compassion, it's just like that much more powerful. And like, I'll never forget that moment ever. And like, he'll always be like my guy for that. You know, like we're close friends and like, we have like kind of a big brother, little brother kind of like relationship at this point. And so like, I'll never forget that moment. And he very well, he had every right to just be coming in and yelling, you know, fuming. And just like, I honestly think that would have like changed my trajectory on the whole project on the whole town. It would change, like, not to be like too dramatic about it, but it could have like changed the direction of the town's history. You know, it could have just been, oh, I'm going to pack up and leave. And it just stays an empty lot instead of this, like now it's like a celebratory kind of like Phoenix out of the ashes type situation. And a lot of it's contributed to like his in that moment of like, you know, in that moment, kind of the words that he said.
Yeah, I found that story of what you just said very special because I kind of feel the same way where if I was in your shoes and he came at me like, what have you done? I would have been like, yeah, I'm out, you know, I'm sorry, I'm leaving. But he kind of gave you that like really wise, powerful word. And you're like, okay, I'm going to build this place up. And now you think you're going to complete it. Is it this year?
Yeah, this year, hopefully we're done. And like I said, it's been a crazy battle because we've built it up in the middle of nowhere. And so it should be done this year, open for visitors again, which will be cool. And then hopefully now, you know, for another 150 years, at least, maybe longer, people can come up here and kind of get that same understanding of the history, the same natural beauty of looking at all the mountains and stuff like that. And so it's it's really cool. And I think the process of getting it rebuilt has been very collaborative. A lot of people have helped out in different ways, whether it's people that watch some of my YouTube videos that come up to help, or like different people in the area. And so I think it's really cool that in a time where sometimes social media gets kind of a bad rap, you know, like, oh, it can be negative. Like, social media is kind of like rebuilding a historic structure from scratch. And that's kind of fun.
Yeah, you have a very cool YouTube channel. I recommend anyone listening, if you haven't already, check it out. And I think it's called the same thing as the book, right? Ghost Town
yep.
Living?
Correct, yep.
Yeah, check out Ghost Town Living, because it's just a really fascinating to be able to watch the journey. And the videos are done really well, too. So
thank you.
That's really cool that you get to kind of like continue the history, and at now the next chapter, we get to follow along.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's pretty cool. Do you run into much wildlife up there?
Not really, because there's no water. So big game wants water. And so I found the skulls of bighorn sheep, which is really cool. So there used to be bighorn sheep here back when some of these natural springs, I think, still existed before the miners drained them. But these days, the biggest thing I'll see is a fox or a bobcat, maybe, you know, very rarely.
Yeah.
But nothing in the like giant range. Because basically this side of the valley, so I'm in a valley that's called Owens Valley. And this side of the valley is the high desert, because across from us is the Sierra Nevada. And so basically what happens is all the water comes off the ocean. It hits the Sierra Nevada, dumps all of its precipitation. And then we basically get nothing over here. And so it's like, I'm looking out my window and I can see maybe 7 trees over the course of like 50 acres that I'm looking at, you know? So it's very, very sparse up here.
Yeah. Well, maybe there's going to be like, you know, the next amazing Grammy winning artist will come up there and stay for a month and use the recording studio. And it sounds like a really cool place. I'd love to come check it out when it's finished.
Yeah. I mean, even beforehand, if you want to come up and check it out, we're open every day, like 9 to 5. People can come in and look at the museum. It's free to charge. Like, we don't charge anybody to come. But if you want to come, I'll give you a tour. I'll show you everything you want to see. It's a cool place.
Nice. Nice. Will you take, will the public be able to go down the mine or no?
No, I've tried a bunch of times and the insurance says that's gross negligence is what they say. And so you can't insure away gross negligence, I guess. And so the public won't be going in the mine. It's just, at the end of the day, it's just too dangerous, to be honest.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
I think that's part of why I make the video, so people can see what it's like without having to go down there. But it's just too dangerous.
Yeah, insurance is like, absolutely not.
Yeah, no, not a chance.
Don't even ask that again.
Yeah, that was the response I got, basically.
Don't even ask. Yeah. Well, I think it's amazing. Have you found any gold or silver down there?
Yeah, I found some of the galena, which is the mine mineral they were mining before. And I understand the whole process of refining it now, down all the way down to pure silver, which is a thing. And so I've actually taken it all the way down. I've made rings out of it before, pendants, coins and stuff. And so it's kind of cool. Not enough to do any like commercial mining, but just enough to tinker around with myself, which is fun.
Yeah, nice. Well, as this is Can You Survive This Podcast, I have created a little hypothetical survival scenario for you.
Sweet.
As we do with all the guests. This one I kind of tailored to be in your world, in your realm of restoring a historic mining town.
Cool.
So hopefully some of these questions will be, you know, interesting and informative for the audience. And let's run through this, and please feel free to like elaborate on, well, you said A or B, but actually C, you know, I would do C or something like that.
Yeah.
So if you're up for it, let's run through it.
Definitely.
All right, great. Let me get my notes out. And all right. For this scenario, you are on a mission to revitalize an old mining town, preserve its heritage, and create a thriving community once again. First question, do you A, conduct thorough research on the town's history, including its origins, mining operations, and notable landmarks, or B, begin demolition work on parts of the property that need the most work?
I'd go A.
A, fantastic.
Yep, no hesitation.
Excellent. A is correct. You choose to conduct thorough research on the town's history, immersing yourself in its origins, mining operations, and cultural significance. Armed with this knowledge, you're better equipped to make informed decisions and honor the town's heritage during the restoration process. Next, do you A, engage with community members to gain insights and support for the restoration project, or B, assemble a team to help in the restoration process based on the lowest bidder?
Definitely A. It's something I've been done. The local community has some gems of info that I feel like they've earned over the last couple of decades, and you can kind of tap into that pretty quickly.
Yeah. So are you in your restoration? Are you mostly working with locals?
Yeah, I'd say almost everybody. And then the local community is the people that, you know, guide what I do a lot in day in day. I have kind of like, they're not official advisors or anything, but close friends in the community that I kind of run by things by, and they kind of let me know what would be most appropriate in certain circumstances.
Cool. Cool. All right, moving right along. You got that one correct. A is correct. You choose to engage with community members, leveraging their expertise and support for the restoration project. By fostering collaboration and inclusivity, you ensure that the restoration effort reflects the collective vision and values of the community. Next question, and they get a little more interesting as we go, so don't worry. Do you A, implement modern upgrades and renovations to attract visitors and potential residents, or B, prioritize the preservation of key historical structures and landmarks, focusing on maintaining their authenticity and integrity?
I would go B is my answer for that one. I think that keeping what's here, I mean, the reason the town's interesting is what exists already. And so that's kind of got to be the main thing. And so I always keep, there's that phrase, keep the main thing the main thing. And so I try to keep the main thing the main thing.
Yeah, for sure. I also, you know, with historical places, I also like to think, like, I like visiting historical places too. I was just in Mexico, like traveling all over the Yucatan and checking out like all these pyramids and stuff.
Yeah.
But I also like to think about like in 100 or a few hundred years, the next people that will visit here, and then like kind of they'll be able to see like, oh, all the history of like, here's the first layer, and then you can see where they kind of preserved it, but then they continued using it, and you can tell that they built 100 years later. And then, you know, in 100 years, people are going to be like kind of gauging the hundreds or thousands of years that the site has been used for different things. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. I think that's what makes cities interesting, right? I think if a city's built all at once, then it doesn't have character. I think that's why, at least in my mind, like, some places like Dubai, for instance, isn't necessarily as interesting as like a Paris, or to me anyways, because Paris has been built over many hundreds of years, you know, and some buildings get knocked down, some get built up. And so you kind of have that cool mix. And so, yeah, we have that here now. And I try to leave little Easter eggs for future generations. You know, I can't tell you how many time capsules I've buried around the property. Cause I try to think like, what would I love to find from 150 years ago? I'd love to find like, and I try like in the walls of any building that I've worked on, there's notes, there's things, there's a lot of things that hopefully will bring a smile to somebody in the future.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And yeah. And even some of the pyramids that I visited in Mexico, like you can read the little plaques and they're like, well, we can see the foundation was 300 years or 1,000 years old, but then we can see that this section was built several hundred years later, and they must have, you know, the civilization continued to use it for a new thing. And I just find that stuff really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so awesome that you're leaving Easter eggs for yes, for people as well. Let's see here. Okay, now it is becoming winter time, and you're now living on the property full time. When you wake up in the morning, the first thing you do is A, drink water to start the day hydrated, or B, start a fire to warm the house.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'll say what I do. I typically try to get the fire going, to be honest. Then I try to get water, just because it can get, there's no central heat, so it gets painstakingly cold, like in the teens inside the house. And so it makes the drinking of the water a little bit more enjoyable once you have a little warmth. But I could see an argument for the first one too. I could see that you could sit on both sides of the equation there. But that's kind of what I typically do.
Yeah. Okay. So you're warming the place up.
Yep.
Okay. B is correct. Yes. Now you get the fire going, but during the renovation process, you come to realize you will need much more water on site than you had originally anticipated. You get a tip from a local that there is a well with plenty of fresh water on the land, but you must hike to it. So do you A, hike to find the water immediately, or B, collaborate with your team to find the best route and let people know where you will be?
I would let people know where I would be. I think that I live 6 miles from Death Valley National Park, and I would say most people that die in Death Valley are because they went somewhere without telling anybody where they were going to go. And so that's kind of a lesson I've learned from the countless headlines of people I've heard about in Death Valley.
Correct. B is correct. you let the team know where you will be, and you have contingencies in place. Ready for your hike to find water, do you A, grab some extra lightweight supplies that you may need on the hike, or B, begin the hike as early as possible so you don't lose daylight?
I bring some supplies. I think that they're always going to... I've been on a lot of long hikes here, and I wish I could have had a couple more things. And so I think that's a little more manageable. That can get you out of more things than a little bit of daylight can.
Fantastic. A is correct. And one of the things you grab is the InReach. I actually learned about the InReach from reading your book. I had never heard of that, but it's like a GPS or something, right?
Yeah, it's a GPS coordinator where people can see where you are all the time, and then you can send outbound text messages. And there's if things get really bad, there's an SOS button where essentially you press that, a helicopter is going to come to as close as they can get to you as fast as they can get to you. And so it's a lifesaver, especially when you are hiking in the backcountry where there's no cell service, and then you're many miles from anybody else. The InReach is just like a game changer.
Amazing. Yeah, I learned about that from your book. So for anyone listening out there that is doing adventures, definitely check out the InReach, which is like a GPS system. Sounds like something you definitely want to have on you.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's pretty small?
Yeah, there's different size ones. I get what's called the InReach Mini, and it's maybe only like 2 or 3 inches tall. And so I can put it on my pocket here. And what it can do is actually can connect into your Bluetooth or your phone. So you can text within the app as if you have cell service. They limit it. Don't go crazy. You get like 10 texts a month, I think. So they're very much for like, if you're in trouble. It's not I want to stay online when I'm out in the middle of nowhere. Because I think part of the going out there is to not be online. But yeah, if you get in a pickle, I mean, it's literally like a lifesaver.
Yeah. Yeah. I would imagine also that being out in the middle of the nowhere, it's a nice treat to yourself to not go online.
Totally. Yeah, definitely.
I last year I traveled to the Amazon rainforest.
Oh, nice.
And I spent about 10 days in the jungle, and I was with some friends, and they were like, hey, there's a village. If we cross the river and go on a small hike, there's a village with Wi-Fi. Do you want to come with us? And I was like, I'm not really sure. And then another friend in the group was like, why don't you do yourself a favor and not do that? Because you have 10 days to not be on Wi-Fi. Why don't you just enjoy the actual magic of that?
Definitely. Yeah, I would. I think that was the right call.
Yeah, for sure. And I didn't use the Wi-Fi. But about speaking of the InReach, I think it's also wise for people that are just listening. You kind of indicated of like clipping it onto like your backpack strap or something.
Yeah.
Definitely want to note that that's probably something that you want to keep easily accessible, not like buried in your backpack, because you know, if you slide down a hill and you're injured, you want it to be very accessible.
Yeah. And you don't want it on the bottom of your bag, because if you drop your bag or you hit something, then it's going to break. So you want it the least likely place of impact if you were to fall, and the easiest to access. So I would say somewhere on your two straps, somewhere by your shoulders is probably the best place to keep it.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. Just trying to educate everyone as we go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So you have your InReach with you. You have it in an accessible location. During your hike, you slip and fall down a steep incline and you injure your leg. You have damaged your water bottles. So you've lost your water and you have an injured leg. So do you A, take a flat, longer route back to your base camp, or B, go back up the steep incline, which is a shorter distance back to camp?
I would take the flat route in that case. I've been in a similar situation, and I did the opposite of that, but I would take the flat route back to base camp if I could have.
Perfect answer. Yeah. The flat route, even though it's a little bit longer, is the way to go, because you're still going to actually exert less energy by going on the flat route than going up. And if you're injured, taking the steep route actually risks making the injury worse.
Totally.
So you got that right. You take the flat route back to camp, you make it back, and you rest your leg for a couple days. After you've rested for a couple of days, do you A, venture into the abandoned mine to search for hidden water sources, risking danger but potentially securing a vital resource, or B, seek alternative sources of water outside the town, avoiding potential hazards in the abandoned mine?
If I had an injured leg, I would avoid the abandoned mine. That would be my take.
Yeah.
Although I've been in mines with an injured leg, I would try to avoid them whenever I could.
Yeah. Good answer. Now, is it possible that there could be water, a water source down in the mine?
Sometimes. Yeah. So the main mine that we have 700, that goes 900 feet down, at the 700 foot level, there's actually a little bit of the shaft where water drips in from the ceiling. And so the miners back in the day dug out like a sump. So like a pool down there, basically, where the water can trickle into. And so we've on occasion pumped out water from the mine to use on toilets and stuff like that up here. It's unreliable because when it gets cold, the pipes will freeze and stuff, but there can be water sources. I mean, some mines are, they hit the water line and they're completely submerged completely. They have to pump them out always, different mines around the country. But up here, we don't really have that problem. We kind of have the opposite problem of not having enough water, but it could be water back in a mine. I also don't know that I would drink a ton of water in a mine, you know, because it can sometimes be a little
it can be contaminated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see here. Last question. Do you A, explore the surrounding wilderness for natural resources such as timber and stone to supplement restoration materials and minimize costs, or B, rely solely on imported materials and supplies for restoration projects?
I mean, the less you have to move around, the better. I would look around, try to find some stuff in the area, use what I could. You know, I bring stuff up because we need it, but if I could repurpose any of the material around here, it saves me an 8-mile dirt road trip. And so that's usually what I try to go for.
Fantastic. Congratulations. Your visionary leadership, strategic planning, and commitment to community engagement have transformed the abandoned mining town into a thriving cultural hub and sustainable destination. You yes. have survived this podcast.
All right. Oh,
yeah. I tried to make that one kind of a little bit in your world. Yeah. So
I liked it. Yeah. It was a lot of tie-ins to the things that have happened up here before too.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you can share? Like anything that surprised you along your journey living up there that you didn't expect that you had to kind of navigate?
Yeah. I just think that the level of preparation up here is so much more than anywhere else. Because again, you're not running, you can't. When I lived in Austin, I could go to the grocery store 3 times a day if I wanted to. You know, it's right down the street. I could go to Home Depot 5 times a day. And so up here, you kind of have to learn to like think ahead a little bit more. What are you going to need for the next month? If you don't have this, then how are you going to figure it out? You know, if you're building if you're making this door on this shed, how are you going to make a hinge if you don't have a hinge? And so just a little bit of like preparation, I think, is like the main thing that I found important up here.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for coming on. I honestly enjoyed just like talking about the mine and like,
yeah.
I feel like I could do another hour of like, well, what else have you found down there? What other stories? Well, how many, you know, newspaper clippings and interesting stories have you found?
Yeah.
What else can you, before we sign off, like where can people find you? Where can people find out about the hotel and also the book Ghost Town Living?
I would say the best place to keep up to date is just the YouTube channel, which is called Ghost Town Living. I try to put out a video or two a month that kind of goes over the progress on all the different projects here. So if you're interested in mine explorations, I have some crazy mine explorations, a building renovation on there. I have dirt bike rides, hikes, you know, very dangerous stuff. If you're into that, check out that. The book, I would say, like, if you're, you know, it's for somebody that wants to lean into life. If they're thinking about that life of adventure, if they want to be that kind of life and they're kind of looking for another example of somebody going all in on their passion, you know, kind of going after the big project. If you're thinking about the project on your sideline, I think I try to weave in a lot of stories from other people doing the same thing that I did throughout it. And so I would check that out because I think it's, I'm really proud of it. So I think it's a good book.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic book. I haven't finished it yet, but I'm really enjoying it so far. Ghost Town Living is the book. Everyone check it out. It is out March 19th.
Yep.
And Brent Underwood, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Of course, this is a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. Bye, everyone.